The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
You just have got to be flexible, but you have to have insurance. If you don't own any gold or silver or these things, you better own some. Now, how much you need, that depends on your personal situation, your personal preferences, just like any good insurance salesman would tell you. You look at it, you figure out what you need and what kind of mix of coins or bullion, whatever you want to do here. But I do think you better have that as a safety net.
Now, here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, one of my favorite guests, and we have him on sometimes a couple of times a year, Bill King. He is a street fighter of trading. When you talk to theory guys, academics, people who are studying these things but never really having to apply them, they can bring interesting things to the table. But then you've got a guy who's actually lost money with theory and doesn't want to do it again and then starts making money with actual experience. That's Bill King.
Well, the King Report is something that we read internally on a daily basis, and it's an invaluable resource for us, and something I would highly recommend to people who have the same strange fascination with the markets and politics and finance that we do. So it's been a compliment to us in terms of what we do and how we think. And we do enjoy the conversations we have with Bill when he joins us in the commentary each time.
Well, Dave, like you said, this is something we read every day. You know, we get an awful lot of research on our desk, but frankly, if I don't have hardly any time in a day, if it's a busy day, Bill King, I just don't miss the King Report. He's done this for, what, four decades, going on to five?
There is an inherent value when someone has done something over and over and over again. Not for a week, not for a month, not for a year, but for a decade. And by the way, at the end of this month, we're celebrating our eighth year here at the Weekly Commentary. But we're still trailing Bill King by at least three decades. He's been doing what he's done for four decades. And so, Bill, you know, looking at first quarter dynamics, it's been fascinating to watch in the investment markets. In a word, it's been volatile. How would you describe the first quarter in sort of narrative form? We've had the commodity swings, we've had the stock market declines, a recovery. At a certain point, investors just step away because of that byword, volatility.
Well, I think the first quarter has been a microcosm of the past several years. You see, you've got this systemic deflation, retrenchment in economies, or whatever you want to call it, and you have the central banks fighting that by trying to inflate. And then every time stock prices start rolling over or you start getting the key technical levels, central banks come in and intervene, and they intervene both in real terms, real action, and verbally. Now, how many times are we going to see that, where the economy looks bad, stock market's rolling over, some kind of banking crisis, and all of a sudden the central banks all come together and start running their mouths, you know, cutting rates, doing whatever they have to do to pop up asset prices? And that's exactly what has just happened again. Groundhog Day, over and over and over.
When you look at the Fed, how trapped would you say the Fed is?
Well, they're beyond trapped, but they've lost all credibility, and they're losing it again today. I mean, in the last couple of days, there's been a parade of Fed officials out there going, oh, we should hike in April, inflation is picking up, and today Bullard's saying it looks like we might overshoot at inflation. People are just going, these guys have lost all credibility. They say they're data-driven, they ignore the data. Even the Fed's measures of inflation beyond core, the sticky wage of the Atlanta Fed and the Cleveland trend mean, you know, PCE are all showing inflation above thresholds that they've highlighted for years, yet they didn't hike. And now they're turning around and the guys are all, you know, running out saying, well, we should have hiked and we still can hike. And people are going, what is wrong with you guys? And of course, I think the cat was left out of the bag last night when Philadelphia Fed President Harker said, well, one of the reasons we didn't hike, and he gave a hawkish address last night about we should be hiking rates, and he said one of the reasons they didn't was because of market volatility. Now, that's a euphemism for both stock prices were down. And people are looking at these guys going, what is wrong with you? You hike in December when the economy looked bad. You had good numbers in January. Inflation takes off. China stabilizes. You know, capital was pouring out of China in the fourth quarter and into January. Come February, you don't hear that about China anymore. That whole capital outflow and the conversion of dollars just dried up. There's really not been a problem. Oil bottomed in mid-February and took off. There was no reason for them not to hike rates. All the excuses they used in the past, China, oil, you know, the inflation, the economy, none of those were there. In fact, it was contrary, and that he didn't hike rates. And of course, you saw an ex-economist from the Fed a couple days ago put an article out. The reason they didn't hike rates is because of politics. You know, they don't want the market down in an election year to hurt their people. So there's just no credibility with the Fed right now.
They've committed to raising rates, and there is more talk about raising rates. Do we see the same thing happen again? You know, they raise rates in December, and the markets start to sell off significantly, January and February. Are we back to that if they feel like they have to save face and regain some degree of credibility by raising rates? Do we just sort of wash, rinse, repeat January and February all over again?
That's it. They've lost their credibility. And I think the Fed is divided. I think there's some serious people there that want to do what's right. And then I think you got the political, you know, scoundrels. I mean, you know, you got the Fed screaming about you can't audit us, you can't look at what we're doing, or you're going to hurt our independence. And yet you have them contributing money and a preponderance going to Democrats. And, you know, Lael Brainard just gave money 2 months ago to Hillary Clinton. I mean, you talk about tone deaf. Is it tone deaf, or is it like the other politicians where they're just arrogance, that they believe they're in control of the economy? You got a handful of academics that are running a command economy here, and they don't care. And then you got the peckless leaders in Congress that let these guys get away with this because they're papering over the tough decisions that the Congress should be making. So it's a terrible mix. And what you get is, you know, people getting squeezed by the Fed. And you see this in so many different areas, and it's reflective in the politics that's going on and dissatisfaction in the public. So there's two sides to this story. One is the Wall Street. The other is what's happening to average Americans. And, you know, Wall Street did well for a number of years. Now Wall Street's not doing so well. And I think that's why, you know, the Fed ignored the average person for a couple decades, but they kept Wall Street in their corner. But now with the volatility, now with all the layoffs on Wall Street, and the street is kind of turning on the Fed has few friends. And if you looked at the last testimony of Yellen in front of Congress, both sides of the aisle pounded her. You know, in the past, Democrats were supporting, whether it was Greenspan or Bernanke, because they're pumping easy money. And, you know, and you had Charlie Schumer telling Bernanke, get to work, Mr. Chairman. And that meant only one thing, pump more credit in here, pump more easy money. This time, you had the Republicans beating up on Yellen for the easy money, and you had the Democrats pounding on her for not regulating the big banks and for skewing income and concentrating income and wealth. They're both talking the same coin, but the different side, and that was the real surprise. Yellen had very few defenders, and part of it's an election year, but it's also the Fed has put themselves in the corner here.
You know, going back to that issue of Brainard's contributions, Bloomberg noted that about 79% of federal-level campaign contributions from Federal Reserve staffers since 2014 to the present have gone to Democrats. And you just wonder, are monetary policy prerogatives vulnerable to party politics and personal bias? Is there more accommodation and verbal dovishness from the Fed leading into the election? We kind of saw that a little bit with Ben Bernanke in the era of quantitative easing 3, which he announced just 2 months before the 2012 elections. At what point does the general public say, look, you're making decisions which don't represent the interests of America or of Americans? This is dirty.
I think the public has been saying that. And I think that's what Congress now is going after the Fed, is they know the people are upset. And of course, politicians don't want to blame themselves. They look for other people first, and only reluctantly will they look at themselves. And the Fed is in an end game for itself. The Fed keeps jumping beyond what their mandate has been. Again, you've got academics that have little or no real world experience in industry or banking, and they're running their theories here. These academics are used to coming from universities where they bullied teenagers, you know, and young adults and browbeat them, and they're not used to being challenged. And more importantly, you could take these theories into practice and they're blowing up. This is decades of theory and thought and research blowing up on them. And they don't know what to do. And they've bet the U.S. economy and banking system on it. So that's why they keep doubling down here. And that's why they keep, every time you look like the stock prices want to go down or the commodities are rolling over, these guys panic because they don't know what to do. You heard Bernanke years ago say that, you know, when you're near the zero bound, 98% of monetary policy is verbal. You know, let's not stop the pretense. Verbal means BS. We're going to BS the markets. We're going to talk them up. That's all that verbal means, is we're going to threaten you know, that we're going to pump even more credit. And why would you do that? There's only one reason to do it, and that is to push stock prices up. That's the only reason you say we have to have the verbal intervention. Draghi's maneuver, they've all been doing it, and that's back to your initial question about the volatility, but you also lose your credibility when you're doing something like that. So it's a terrible mix. It's a dangerous mix. You know, you see the dissatisfaction in Wall Street for the first time, well, probably since 2009. And, you know, the general public has been dissatisfied, so the Fed has very few friends. Probably the only friend they had are a handful of politicians, but the politicians are starting to understand how dissatisfied the American public is. And there's something unpleasant that's going to happen to the Fed, especially if you get a anti-establishment candidate, whether it's Sanders, Cruz, or Trump in there. The Fed's going to have a price to pay, and it's not going to be pleasant.
So let's go back to that issue of politicians now being critical of the Fed. And, you know, for the longest time, they've allowed for monetary policy to do the heavy lifting where fiscal policy has taken a back seat. And we could be sort of transitioning from monetary policy stimulus to fiscal policy stimulus. What do you think the implications are for growth, for inflation, for asset price volatility, if in fact politicians are sort of taking the reins back? Does that make the course more predictable as people just say, hey, look, no, somebody's got it under control. If it's not the Fed, then it's Congress and it's these massive trillion-dollar spending programs or whatnot. Do we ignore risk? Or do people begin to realize this is desperate and they're just grasping at straws?
Well, people realize increasingly how desperate the situation is and how the Fed is. But you're broaching a key subject. And anytime you go for a restructuring, there's pain. And that's what Reagan did when he came in. He took the restructuring in 81 and 82, and it was very painful. And then, you know, finally we came out of it, and we had a boom for a couple decades based on Reagan and Volcker biting the bullet and doing what you had to do there in 81 and 82. Now, you know, depending on who comes in here, you're going to take this restructuring. You can take the Fed out of the game, you know, whatever you want to do. Whoever comes in, you're going to have some type of restructuring, and there's going to be pain. The question is, will you take it early? See, that's what we didn't do because of 08, 09. You didn't take any of the restructuring. You just started printing money right away. Same thing Bush in 2001. Economy was rolling in recession. You had 9/11. Instead of taking the hit from the excesses of the bubble and Clinton, you know, to stay out of jail when they ran the bubble there in 98, 99, they immediately started stimulating instead of taking the hit. And, you know, that led to the later problems of the housing bubble and then 2008 and 2009. And what we've done here, we've gone straight through. You know, Trump has alluded to this a couple times, and I'm anxious to see if he's going to do this in the general campaign, is he's laying this on the Fed for trying to protect, you know, Obama here by keep running a bubble. And he says it. The media just keeps glossing over, but he just said this again this week. The Washington Post editorial board is, we're $19 trillion in debt. We got to cut back our commitments to NATO. We can't afford this. And we're in a bubble, and it's going to burst, and it's going to be ugly. So it's interesting to see how this is going to play, because everybody understands what we have is unsustainable. And if it's unsustainable, it means it's going to end. And then you have to do some kind of restructuring transition, and it's going to be painful.
Monetary policy, you talk about 2008 and 2009 just a moment ago. We have monetary policy, which today is resulting in sort of corralling investors into riskier assets. And it seems to mirror the policy choices and the market responses that we saw in 2008 and 2009. Is there a culpability issue with today's central bankers? Is that what Trump is ultimately going to do, is say, look, no, we're here and people are being destroyed financially. Savers in the middle class are being destroyed because of these policies.
Well, he's saying that. Cruz is intimating it too, and even Bernie Sanders. You know, those are the three anti-establishment candidates right now. And, you know, the Wall Street ran around for the years saying, oh, this is good. You know, it was decades ago, and I can't remember the guy's name at General Motors, made the statement, what's good for General Motors is good for America. The media bashed him, but the general public understood that. What he was saying is that when business does well, the average American does well. And then we got to the late 90s with the bubble, and average Americans weren't doing well, and it proceeded to get worse for the next decade or two. And then people, you know, were joking that what the establishment was trying to say is what's good for Goldman Sachs is good for America. And Americans get more and more disenfranchised from that. They no longer believe that when the stock market is booming, it's good for America, because it hasn't translated. And three of the four candidates are anti-establishment here. and they're going to run against Wall Street. Now, Hillary's going to try to run against Wall Street, but she's got a problem because of taking all the money from Goldman and the other people in here. But that's what the politicians are reluctantly figuring out here, is how dissatisfied, how disenfranchised Main Street is. You know, this is Main Street against Wall Street, it's going to be. You know, I mean, for years, the establishment said, well, tried to tell Americans, well, as long as Wall Street's doing good, you're going to be doing good. That's broken down over the last two decades. That existed in the post-World War II era for, you know, many decades. But the average Americans understand it. The political class doesn't understand it, but what is going on now, you know, they're starting to figure it out based on what Bernie Sanders and Trump and Cruz are doing here, that all of a sudden, yeah, you know what, something's wrong here. And I love these people all going, oh, we can't understand this, really. You haven't paid attention to the polls and surveys for the last 10 years. The average American, they're fed up with these trade deals. They're fed up with, you know, talking about how these things are going to be good for the average Americans, and they're not. They're only good for the ruling class. And that's, there's a revolt on. There's no question there's a revolt going on here. And, you know, it's been going on for years, and it keeps poking its head up. You know, first was the Tea Party, and that was suppressed mainly by the GOP establishment. And then all of a sudden, the revolt just gets stronger and stronger, and something's coming here. It's going to be interesting to see how the election, the campaign plays out here, but whoever comes in is going to have a daunting problem in here, because we're at the end. Even the central bankers are saying, you know, we're at the limit. Bernanke, you know, very quietly last week, the media underreported, he said, we're approaching the limit here of monetary policy. You know, for years they said, when you said, well, gee, you're at the zero bound, you've done all this QE, you know, you're out of bullets. And the central bank, oh, no, we can do more. Like what? You can only do two things. All you can do is create credit, and then you can lower rates. That's all you can do. So don't say there's more you can do. And you create credit by monetizing bonds. What do you think you're going to do, monetize ETFs like Japan or monetize commodities? Well, you're doing that already indirectly. But for Bernanke to make that admission is, you know, we're just, yeah, that's about it here. And even Draghi's now saying that. These guys understand that. They understand once they went to the negative rates that they're hurting people more than helping, but they can't back out of it. You see in the Bank of Japan, it's a global phenomenon right now. So it's very difficult to navigate right now, because anybody that's dealing in the markets understands that they're artificial. And this gets back to your point here. You have artificial markets, artificial prices. The volume is collapsing here because nobody wants to play, because you don't want to buy stocks or even some commodities at artificial levels, but you don't want to really short them because you're afraid that these guys keep intervening in here. And of course, that was what happened in 08, the first half of 08. Well, the, you know, everybody on the inside knew the financial system was collapsing, but the Fed kept giving you all these alphabet soups of facilities. Remember TAF, the TSL, was a TSLC, and then primary dealer facility. I mean, they just kept trying these things out every other week of these aids, and it kept people in the market. It kept the hedge funds in, kept the institutions in. Then you had, all of a sudden, the collapse showed up, and they all got caught, and they're doing the same thing again. But this time will be worse.
Well, on a similar note, we've got perceptions which are being controlled. You've got people who are staying in large part because there is this meme that we are in recovery. And if you look at official statistics and economic numbers, the ones that are highly advertised, you know, no one really cares about the seasonal adjustments and the impact that that has. But you are. You're controlling and manipulating a perception, which is keeping people engaged perhaps longer than they should be. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the significance of a seasonal adjustment and how, for the insider, maybe it makes sense and you know what's happening, but for the common man, it's actually why you're at jeopardy.
Well, again, it gets back to desperate times. These are desperate times. When you're $19 trillion in debt, the Fed has been running the most promiscuous and outrageous monetary policy in history and for the spell. I mean, you go back and look at World War II and what you had to do in the mobilization and in the aftermath. It's nothing compared to what we're doing now. And there is this desperation. You know, people understand they're at the end of something here. And they rode the tiger and they can't jump off because they're going to get eaten by it. So everybody's looking for the magic genie to show up and save them. And it's not going to happen. But there's no other recourse. So they just keep playing the game, whether it's the Fed, whether it's elected officials. So you just keep moving down the street. And you're right. They want to keep people in. And when you come back to everything, it's the debt. And again, listen to the candidates. Is anybody talking about the debt here? The debt is the reason we're having all these problems. And when the debt blew up in 08, 09, and when you get the dreaded debt default, that's when the sovereigns and the central bank saved the bank, saved whoever they could. You know, that's what people didn't understand, is that the sovereign countries put more risk on themselves. So all this crisis in the European world, which besides the 09, we had 11, 12, then the Greek thing in 14, 15, it just keeps showing up here because you can't pay the debt. So everybody's playing the shell game here about how are we going to, well, we'll have the ECB, they'll buy all the debt, or the Bank of Japan, or everybody, you know, everybody's going to find somebody to buy all this debt or to paper it out. But that's the problem. And we keep increasing the debt. And that's what the central banks, they're all concerned once that debt deflation starts. You know, it is, it's game over. And then it drags down everybody. You know, Japan, China, it is a debt problem. It's absolutely a debt problem. And it goes back to what Margaret Thatcher said, the problem with socialism is eventually you run out of other people's money. And that's what has happened. You ran out of money. I mean, if you go back when the U.S. was piling up all these debts in, you know, the late 60s and 70s, and that's, you know, Nixon shut the gold window, and then gold and silver boomed until 1980. And then, you know, the Reagan and Volcker kind of bought us time. But by the late 80s, everybody was, you know, in the late 70s, everybody thought that Saudi Arabia was going to fund, you know, that's where the key term was recycle petrodollars. Anybody that was around remembers that. That, you know, Walter Wriston and David Rockefeller, you know, the Chase and Citibank CEOs, the most important bankers in the U.S. were talking about, we have to recycle these petrodollars. That's how we keep the U.S. economy going, because all this wealth was going into OPEC. Then we get into the 80s, it was Japan. Oh, Japan had all the money in the world. So we're going to recycle all that money. You know, they're going to come here and they buy Rockefeller Center and Pebble Beach, and that's how we're going to keep the economy. That's how we're going to sustain all this debt. You know, and then in the 90s, we did have a situation here because of the bankruptcy of communism, where everybody wanted to buy the dollar. You know, you had China, you had the Eastern Europe, you know, the Soviet Union, all this was imploding. The Japanese bubble was burst, so people had insatiable demand for dollars, so, you know, Greenspan could pump money, could fund all the debt, and then that all blew up in 2000, and in the last decade, you know, then we started talking, well, it was going to be China. You know, China had all this money. In, you know, in the 2000s, the decade there and there, we have to recycle that money. And yeah, okay, you know, all that money we're sending to China, but it's going to come back here in investment and blah, blah, blah. But you can see how this thing is played out, that we keep taking on debt, same with Europe, the Western world, and everybody's looking for the magic genie that's going to keep the game going. And right now, you're out of magic genies. Your last one was China, and they overplayed their hand, just like the Saudis overplayed theirs, just like Japan overplayed theirs, just like the U.S. overplayed theirs in the 60s. And now you're left with enormous amounts of debt that anybody with a modicum of understanding in mathematics knows it's unpayable. You cannot grow out of $19 trillion in debt.
Back to lower rates. I mean, is this the final genie where, you know, we know that there's been a high cost to savers, billions of dollars in lost income to savers. And the presumption of central bankers, as you say, primarily academics, is that if you lower rates, it's going to stimulate growth. And yet we've found this transition point at the zero bound where all of a sudden the rate structure is no longer stimulative, but it's actually creating an economic breaking instead. Are they recognizing that, or are they clinging to what they must in hopes that, no, we can manage high levels of debt as long as the interest paid on that debt is paper thin?
Well, it's actually both, and in a bizarre way. And I think, you know, you're articulating an important point here, is that unless you're really stupid, you have to understand that it's not working. And you see there's reluctant admission by a number of people, even Draghi. The new mantra is with the central banks. You know, for decades, is we can always save the world, and we're going to show you. Now it's like, you know, all these measures are just temporary. You guys got to restructure. You know, this is on the governments now. We can't keep doing this. So there is that admission. But on the other hand, you know, they're the captain of the Titanic. You know, what's his name? John Smith. And the boat's going down, and he knows it, and what's he going to do? You know, he can't run around and create panic and say, you know, you're all going to die, or most of you are going to die, or whatever. He just has to keep the stiff upper lip and try to keep people calm, and, you know, hopefully somebody comes in, the Carpathian, whoever comes and picks up the survivors. And I think that's what's starting to happen in here. They've played this game for 7 years now, and it's making matters worse. Just what you said is you're taking money from the masses, putting it in a few hands, and then the people that have the access and have the ability to leverage that money are winners. And that's why you've had this concentration of wealth. The people that control large amounts of assets have won, and you've taken all this interest income away from literally billions of people around the globe and putting it in a few hands. And you're right. Part of the low interest game is to help the people that are in debt, which are mostly sovereigns. I mean, can you imagine if you had the normal 5 or 6% interest rates now in the U.S. on that debt? I mean, you'd be talking, you know, in excess of $1.2 trillion in interest payments per year. That's astounding. And that's part of the game. There's no question that's part that the central banks are trying to facilitate the government debt here. I mean, that's what Trump has talked about, how the Fed has been bailing out Obama and creating this bubble and, you know, bailing out Congress so nobody has to make any decisions here. You just let this game go. See, that's the thing now, is what the game has become for the Fed and for the sovereigns. Who's going to take the hit when it blows up? Who's going to take the blame? And that's where you can see Draghi and the other central bankers who are trying to move away. You know, they're starting to say, hey, where they were rock stars and look at, well, aren't we great guys and we saved the world. Now they're like, you know, we can only do this temporarily. It's on the governments to do what they need to do.
It raises the question, who is going to take the hit? Who is going to take the blame? Who is at greatest risk? I mean, you've got the establishment that's in the crosshairs.
Well, that's it right there. They're going to take it. And the establishment is an encompassing term. And it means all the levers of power, the ruling class, which the Fed has become joined at the hip with big government and the big banks. That's the game. And it's been historic. You know, if you look back throughout history, it's always been the ruling class. And when they go on these spending sprees, you know, all the way back to the 17th century, you know, and especially in the 18th century, with all the wars and whatever, when you want to do the government spending, whether it's for the war, for the guns or the butter or both, you got to have somebody to finance it. So it was always, you know, the financiers and the bankers and the sovereigns all tied together. And when you had the blow up, whether it was the French Revolution or just some of the other problems throughout the centuries there, that's the establishment. And it's not just government, but it also is the bankers and financiers in that. So in the past, it really fell on the ruling class. But I think now in the age of, you know, internet, whatever, I think you see, and the Fed has brought it on themselves. I remember, you know, 30, 40 years ago, people didn't know. Very few people even knew who the chairman of the Fed was, let alone the president or the vice chair. Now these idiots are out almost daily speaking and running their mouths. They just should shut up and go away. That tells you how much they're trying to influence the markets because they're out there daily. But you can't do that. That's like listening to sports radio every day. I mean, it's just nonsense. You get an element of wisdom here and there, but the amount of noise and jabberwocky is just overwhelming. And this didn't happen before. But it just, again, it shows you how desperate these people are. And also the ego side. And this is all in Greenspan. My gosh, I can't remember how many times Volcker talked during the 80s there. But then all of a sudden, people were slobbering all over Greenspan because, you know, he's creating all this credit and you ran these bubbles. And he got full of himself. And now all these other guys are all full of themselves out there running around talking. And it's not good. It's not good for anybody.
So is it a positive consequence if in the political life cycle of America, we are breaking into an era where the political gridlock between two parties is broken and you end up having a viable third, fourth, fifth party, what have you? Something more representative of the European political system where it's not just a two-party dominated system, but where you've got to create coalitions because everybody's got an opinion and now everyone's being heard as opposed to being marginalized by the ruling classes defined as RNC on the one hand, DNC on the other.
Well, the empirical evidence would suggest that that is even a bigger disaster. Because look what's going on in Europe. As bad as the U.S. is, Europe is far worse. And I think Trump is alluding to this, like, in saying, you know, why don't you guys spend your own money to defend yourselves? We can't keep spending money to defend you guys, especially if you don't have the will to defend yourselves. So why are we spending all this money around the world? And all you guys are doing is then exporting goods to us. And we're protecting you. You got to stop this. So that gets back to your coalitions. And you do have a coalition government here in the U.S. You know, that's what people would argue here is that's the problem, is you don't have anybody come in and address the issues. And when you have coalitions, you know, just like Europe, my gosh, what is going on there since World War One? It's the same nonsense over and over again, waiting for America to come in and protect us and save us. But at the same time, they tell them in the aggregate, don't really care for America. They don't want the influence, but they want the protection. You know, so like they're like teenagers. Don't tell us what to do, but give us the money, give us car keys, give us, you know, shelter, that type of thing. And Trump's like, okay, it's time for you guys to be independent. You want a European Union? Go ahead. We'll take our troops out. You guys defend yourselves against whether it's Russia or radical Islam or whatever, it's time for you guys to act like adults. Figure it out yourself. Again, that when you have all those coalitions in that, you're always coming to consensus. And it usually is not a way to solve a problem. You can even see that, you know, in big businesses and that. Most of your big corporations have a very strong leader. And that's why, you know, you're seeing in the U.S. right now, the movement is they want somebody strong. They want someone that's going to talk tough and be tough. And whether it's terrorists or whether it's Wall Street, whomever. But that's where the Americans are fed up with this coalition type. You don't get anything done because you can't satisfy all these people, special interests. And that's what we have. When you look at these bills that come down, all these little add-ons, all these little things that the lobbyists throw in, it's ridiculous. And you don't know about it for years. And then you say, well, how did that happen? Or how's GE get 35 tax breaks and don't pay any taxes? And you see all these things thrown in. That's the coalition government. And I think that's what people are clamoring for now is a strong man or woman to come in and straighten this out. And that's what we had in the 80s with Margaret Thatcher and with Ronald Reagan. That's what people said, got to clean this thing up. And we're going through it again now. And it's going to be interesting, too, with England in June with their Brexit. I don't think the people have figured out yet how important that could be or how disruptive that can be. And even the Fed is talking about that, about how this could be disruptive to the markets. And maybe that's the reason why they don't want to hike rates here, is because if England pulls out of the EU and that, it could start a domino where other people start pulling out also. But it's all breaking up. You know, you can see this pressure, you know, constantly coming up here. And now you got Merkel. You know, the thing that's held Europe together besides Draghi is Merkel. You know, Germany has been the strong engine of Europe and unchallenged leader, and that is Merkel. And she had this incredible popularity, and she could do what she wanted. But now, because she's totally mishandled the migration crisis there, and the people are fed up, she's in real trouble politically in Europe. You know, you've had the terror attack in France, Brussels. If you have a serious terror attack on German soil now, she's going to be finished. And then when she goes, you know, the far right is really gaining strength there in Germany. You know, it's going to be real interesting to see if they can hold the EU together. Again, if Britain moves out, Merkel starts falling apart here, you're talking another real bad situation in Europe again.
So we roll the clock back to the 90s and maybe even an earlier period where there's greater capital controls, more trade tariffs, people focused on national domestic political issues rather than sort of the grand global themes of trade and cooperation. What does the next 10 years look like in terms of global growth if everyone is becoming more insular in their focus?
Well, it becomes a restructuring. It's unsustainable. You just can't have a handful of countries. It was just like after World War II. You know, U.S. at one point was almost 50% of global GDP. When you think about it, because most of Europe was destroyed, Japan was destroyed, China was not a factor. You know, Russia was still they weren't even a third world country back then. They, you know, they were really primitive. And so the U.S. had this incredible economic hegemony, but it was unsustainable. And of course, that led to the problems we had here in the 70s. And that's what is transpiring here. You can't just have Germany, you know, being the major power in Europe, because what happens is everybody else sits back, and at some point, then you get this concentration of wealth and income, and then you get where the southern regions of Europe are just falling apart. And for a while, the north doesn't care because they're making a ton of money. But then when it stops, and that's what's happened here in Europe, is all of a sudden when the oil went down, all those, the Norway and the Finlands and those that were running these tremendous budget surpluses because of oil. As a household, you can support other people or give the charitable contributions out, but once your income starts falling, you can't do that anymore. And the same thing with Germany. Once they couldn't export to the emerging markets all their machine tools, once that started falling apart, all of a sudden their economy, you know, they can't be the sugar daddies to everybody. And that's what is happening here is, you know, people forget that a decade or a little bit more than that, Germany was a basket case. It's just that with China and emerging markets, you know, buying up their machine tools to industrialize, that Germany got going. And now that's ending for them. So you know, the Germans, Merkel, there was a great political cartoon on today where she's saying, yeah, all you migrants come here, you're good for us, you'll work and pay taxes, and you'll help us culturally here. Well, now, you know, the stories are they can't. The German industries now are saying, we have no jobs. You invited all these people in here. There's no jobs. So all they can do is take benefits from the government, and they're disaffected because they don't have work, and you have that whole bad situation. So, yeah, we're at the end. We're at the end of something here, something big, and I think you know, the rumblings you're seeing in the gold market in the first 2 months of this year were a sign that the insiders know something is going to happen here in the next year or two that's going to be forcing the restructuring. It's not going to be globally, but it'll be a country or two are going to start restructuring here.
So what the gold market was indicating is that the status quo is getting ready to change. The Fed, although we've been talking about the loss of prestige and credibility, there is going to come a point where whether it is the Fed or the ECB or the Bank of Japan, or maybe it's the whole lot of central bankers, the folks have been holding together the sun, moon, and stars in space. And when they lose credibility, there is an adjustment that takes place to asset prices, which to some degree favors gold as a sideline asset, as just an opt-out. We don't know what the world looks like tomorrow, so it's maybe just having something out of the financial system makes sense. Is that more or less what you're saying?
Oh, I think you're dead on, is that, you know, people run around and talk about gold being a hedge against inflation. It's a mediocre hedge against inflation, but it's a terrific hedge against rampant inflation and political upheaval. When people lose faith in politics, they lose faith in the sovereign. And the sovereign is the currency and the debt of that country. Again, the debt and the currency are the same coin, just a different side. And that's what gold is telling you, that they believe the sovereigns and the central banks are losing control of the game. And that's what's going on here. And it caught people by surprise. You know, I thought there was a real good chance gold would make a bottom some point in 2016, just based on, you know, your normal cycles, you know, when tops and bottoms. It was due. I think gold, every time gold is down for 5 years in a row, that's a major bottom, major bottom. And I think it was, you know, 80 peak, and then I think it was, what, 86 or 87 was the low. But you can go back and trace how that kind of works out. And, you know, it was time. It was time for gold to make some kind of bottom in here. But I think it caught everybody by surprise that it really started near the end of December, and by, you know, January it was off to the races in here. And those kind of moves, you can get trader moves where you pop something up, just like the oil move the last couple of weeks was traders playing the seasonal trade for gasoline here. You know, the crude oil and gasoline tend to rally between February and May, especially if the fourth quarter is weak. And that's a seasonal play for gasoline. And that's largely what's been going on here. But the gold move, the way it took off, it smacks of the informed buying. And that's the thing. When you look at a chart, you have to try to ascertain what caused the move. And that's one thing I learned being a trader, is that if something popped up, whether it was a stock or commodity, it was trader-driven. And I've been on the end of that where, you know, we knew other traders, were involved with other traders pushing up a stock or a commodity. And it was, you know, a trader's action, as opposed to if somebody important, like smart money, like the industry, or some important players were buying a stock or buying a commodity. And that's where technical analysis, people rely solely on that, get tripped up, is who is creating the move. Now, the move here in oil is largely trader-driven. The gold move appears to be different. There's a different buyer here that has been buying in the gold here in the first 2 months of the year here. And I think, again, that I think is a more significant move. You know, it took off in a way it's kind of holding in here even now. Gold, it looks like there's somebody serious, some serious people are accumulating gold here. Now, we know some central banks have been buying, but there seems to be a really strong component here to the gold market.
What we're really talking about is a long, drawn-out political and financial restructuring, and that's not something that takes place overnight. So arguably, if you're reflecting a degree of insecurity in the marketplace, in the gold price today, it's not a flash in the pan event in the sense that the restructuring doesn't happen overnight. It has yet to even really commence in earnest. All we're having is a period of discontent and expression of sociological and political frustration, but we haven't gotten to the hard work of taking the pain. So from that standpoint, we could very well be at that early stage, like a 2001-2002, where you see a little perk up and something changes in terms of a trend dynamic, but no one really cares at this point. I mean, after 5 years of gold doing nothing but going down, frankly, the vast majority of people don't care about it. They just don't care. It's not where you'd be looking for opportunities. I mean, there's lots of people who would say, look, oil, the bottom's in, let's buy now. And they're looking for an excuse to buy. I don't see many people looking for an excuse to buy gold. Sentiment's pretty well battered, at least by the man in the street.
Well, gold is a strange dynamic. Is when the average guys are all pouring into gold, it's usually not a good sign. You know, when you have TV commercials selling the gold coins on there, they tend to be at the top. And the reason is the average person doesn't have the means to play the gold market. At best, It would be like them buying an insurance policy. You have to have insurance for all the reasons you know. And you should also have some gold for insurance. But as far as the investment, Wall Street has always hated gold because it usurps their ability to push paper. And that's a given. So the gold market has really been an insider's game. It's been for centuries. And the real action is going on between, you know, the really powerful players, whether it's the central banks or the big private wealth. And they don't want. There's a difference here when people want to buy Apple, and then they're, you know, like Icahn, he's on Twitter telling everybody, you know, he's bought Apple or whatever. You know, you see how the hedge funds and these guys work now. You know, they all want to get on MSNBC or CNBC or get on Twitter and talk about what stock they bought because they want to push it up. Not that they're not serious investors, but they're looking for more of immediate gratification. They want to buy stock. They want to get out there and pump and dump it, push it up, and, you know, whatever. The gold's a different, on a large scale, it's not the same as diamonds, but very close, where it's the big private wealth. They want to move quietly. They don't want to push the prices up away from them. Unlike oil here, we get traders in, they buy it, and then they want to jam it higher immediately. These are serious. When the gold market moves, it's usually big players that are serious. They want some form of anonymity, and they don't want the market to run away from them. If you just look back, that's what I'm saying, that the late December and early January move, you can see a real nice bull pattern. You know, the gold looked like it was falling apart, which it should have at the end of the year. You know, the stock, gold was down, gold stocks are down. You get that end of the year dumping to clean out your portfolios. But instead of dumping, it started down, but then it was getting that nice rounded bottom, that nice saucer bottom, and then it started breaking out. And then the traders came in. And then the traders came in here, you know, by late January and February and came in. But that month or two there was serious accumulation. And again, those are the people that are trying to buy quietly. They want to buy as cheap as possible, and they want a form of anonymity. So the gold market is, the average guy is not a big factor in there. When they are, you know, like the 1980s or whatever, when people were just scared out of their mind, then it goes off to the races. But when the average guy and the average hedge funds are in there playing around, that's when you go and you blow up, just like you saw in 2011 with the silver and the gold. By the time, you know, the average guys figured out what was going on, they just poured into it and they made a peak. And that's why I think right now is it caught most of the street, this rally. It came out of nowhere because everybody thought, gee, the Fed's hiked in December. You know, they're going to hike some more. And the gold market just said, no, we have a different agenda. We have a different belief system. And, you know, it's doing what it's doing in here. The thing will be interesting is the gold market is going to be very dependent on just what you were talking about. Here's this restructuring and how it plays out and who gets elected in here. So I think in the initial stages here that, you know, gold can rally in here. But again, you have to see how this thing politically plays out, not just here, but, you know, also in Japan and China, Europe. There's just a lot of factors, a lot of moving parts here in these markets right now.
What are the odds that we're putting in an important peak this year in equities?
You know, it smells like and feels like it did in 2008, where the economy was receding. The insiders knew, you know, what was going on, but the bankers just kept pushing the asset prices up, kept bringing out these different facilities, trying to hold the system together. And it kept people in the game longer than it should have. And that's exactly what's going on now. You can see the cracks in the economy. And beyond the jump in January economic data, which was, I mean, it was so ridiculous. I can't believe people would actually believe some of the data that came out. And a lot of it was seasonal adjustments. A lot of it was just garbage. I mean, how the heck can you get retailers adding 66,000 jobs in January? After Christmas, after that hiring, when they just, you know, people get, you know, you just unload people like crazy in January. But no, they found 66,000 jobs. And they found this big jump in manufacturing jobs and mining and all this. And it's ridiculous. And, you know, as we keep saying, is the February data, either the economy, U.S. economy fell off a cliff in February, or January was bogus. And it was bogus data. You could see it. It made no sense. But, you know, it kept people in the game. It helped create a stock rally. And now you're back to what's really going on. You're seeing it in housing. You're seeing it, the autos. I mean, how many times have we heard, oh, great auto sales, great auto sales? Yet I looked at, I think it was February, it was a huge amount were going to rental cars and fleets. And you're looking, going, what's going on? Now, you know, we know, you know, the last couple of months there has been problems in the subprime market. But what's happening now is used car prices are tumbling because they're choking on inventory. And I think a couple of weeks ago we saw the inventory to sales. You're at the highest level since the depth of the crisis in 08, 09 in auto sales inventory to sales ratio. It's not just recessionary level. It's crisis level. And that's, we're talking crisis level where you had to bail out GM. And then we've done it again. And we're at this level. And the used car dealers are in trouble. They're trying to keep the inventories. I'm trying to search a story that people are telling me that some of the 2016 models are being withheld from the market because the automakers can't get rid of the inventories of 15s. So we're having a quiet, I don't want to call it a crisis yet, but we're having serious problems in the auto market and the student loan market. You know, the cracks have shown up here. First, it showed up in energy in the fourth quarter of last year in the credit markets. And you know, we were screaming at everybody, look at the credit markets, they're telling you there's a disaster coming. And then finally, the equities caught on. Now we had this enormous central bank intervention over last month from Japan, ECB, and even the Fed here last week. But now that's kind of ending, and you're going to have to deal with the credit issues that are showing up in the market. And you're seeing it even in the consumer credit where people, the first time in years, are taking on a lot of credit, not beyond the non-revolving credit. But you're seeing revolving credit starting to surge. And part of that is because in people, from what I'm talking to bankers, where they're pulling down their lines of credit also, that's telling you that there's something going on bad in the economy and that people are trying to, you know, keep their standards of living going by putting more on credit for now in the hope that something good's going to come later. So it's all there. It's all right there. The only thing holding you in is the central bank intervention keeping people in the game. Not that's keeping Wall Street in the game, but Main Street is largely out of the game. I mean, you're seeing that in the data. The average person are still selling more stocks than they're buying. The buyers right now tend to be the corporations. And it's just that same ugly mix that we had in early 2008. So you're right. You know, how long can you keep this going? Well, we don't know for sure, but we know it's not sustainable.
So putting up the pig with so much lipstick and blush, it is what it is, and perhaps it buys us a little bit of time.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's just nonsense. And what's interesting is just like in 2007 and 2008, the average person knows it's garbage based on their own experience, their own checkbooks, and their own situations. But you get that handful of, you know, the Wall Street paper chasers and handlers that keep trying to paint this rosy picture. You know, you wonder who you think you're fooling. You're fooling each other because the average person on Main Street is not buying it. If they did, you wouldn't have Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. They wouldn't exist if the average person thought everything is as good as the government numbers are or what they're trying to tell you. This wouldn't happen. There's no question there's a revolt going on here in the country. No question. You see it now in Europe is developing politically. And so that's why you can play these games with central banks and the sovereigns until the people revolt. And it's going on. And the next interesting one is going to be Japan, because Abe is really under the gun. They keep doubling down here. And I do think that people with the negative rates are a tax. I can't understand that these academics running these central banks don't understand that negative rates are a wealth tax. And you just crush people. And you're even seeing now, the one interesting thing going on in the U.S. right now, you're seeing it in the surveys, not the polling data per se, but some of these other surveys. What is happening now in the U.S. is the 1%, so to speak, are scaling down their consumption. Our prices are tumbling, are really coming down. Wealthier vacations, and where you had these indexes of, you know, consumer staples against consumer discretionary, but then you also had like the luxury, the high-end retailers, the high-end vacations, the high-end, you know, that whole thing is all starting to come down here. And that's what's interesting here, is this is what the Fed and the government is catered to for, you know, with the wealth effect that will push stock prices up, and then this will all filter down. Well, if the 1%ers are starting to scale down their consumption, for whatever reason, you know, whether they're getting hit in the pocketbook or they think something's bad, you know, that really undermines this whole idea of all this QE and all this wealth effect. And that is one of the things that's going on here. And it's going to be real interesting to see how this plays out here this year, you know, in the GDP.
On a practical note, are there one or two things that you think are pretty critical? 2016, 2017, if there's echoes of 2008 and 2009 painted into this time frame, what are some practical things that you think make sense to do?
Well, and I think we've said this the last couple of years when we've talked, is you just have to be defensive. You just have to have, you know, because we don't know exactly what policies are going to come out here, but we're at the end of this game. So I think you want to pare down as much debt as possible. You want to be liquid, but you want to hedge that liquidity. And, you know, you can hedge that with gold or silver or some other means. You used to be able to hedge it in Forex, but I think that's increasingly difficult because there's very few places to run to. And that's why I think gold is telling you, is that if you can run a safe currency, if you got big money, it's easier and cheaper to run to the currency. When you can't, then you go into gold, and that's more difficult, more expensive. And I think that's kind of what you can see going on in here, is you got to be liquid. But you also have to hedge that liquidity. You have to have the flexibility here to move. And it comes down to, are we going to get the dreaded debt deflation, or are we going to get the inflation that takes off here? And I think that's part of, you know, again, the gold rally here is people are saying, I need the insurance. I need the insurance against not just the inflation, because that is picking up by so many different measures, you know, the core sticky wages, different Fed measures. But it's also the political uncertainty of what's going on here. And you just don't know. Again, Merkel's the linchpin of Europe. And the second most important player would be England. And, you know, England's looking to move out. There's a very strong movement, and the terrorism is probably going to flip the cards over here for a Brexit vote here in June. And it's going to undermine Merkel. And then you've got the U.S. election here, which is starting to look like a 1968 or a 1980, a real transformatory election here, where people want the change. And they're going to vote for who they think the instrument's going to create that change and restructuring. So very difficult year. Don't get ahead of your skis. Get defensive, but be flexible. And I'd be very careful with certain stocks. I did think 2 months ago that some of the energy stocks were so undervalued that they were reasonable. They've jumped up so much here. I think you got to be very careful with your stock investments. We know that the biggest bubble in history is the sovereign bond market. I mean, who would ever thought, you go back a couple of decades ago, that you would see these record amount of debt in unserviceable debt in Japan and in Europe, and they have negative rates on it. That makes no sense. It would tell you they should have sky-high rates. So the area where you really got to be careful is on the sovereign bonds. And I know people keep pushing in the sovereign bonds, and I think that's another reason why you see the gold market picking up here, is that is your hedge. That if those things blow, that actually, if you wanted to go away for 5 years and not have to worry about anything, you'd buy some mix of sovereign bonds and gold, maybe even on a 50-50 ratio, and then just go away, because one of the two is going to win really big for you. But that's what we're facing. This is a very difficult year. We're in a transition period, and you see that. You see that 6-7 year period, you get a transition in here, and you just have got to be flexible, but you have to have insurance. If you don't own any gold or silver, these things, you better own some. It's like, you know, you're walking around without an insurance policy. Now, how much you need, that depends on your personal situation, your personal preferences, just like any good insurance salesman would tell you. You look at it, you figure out, you know, what you need and what kind of mix of coins or bullion, whatever you want to do here. But I do think you better have that as a safety net here.
I know we're out of time, and I'm curious about the G20, if there's any significance to the Shanghai meeting and sort of a marked change in equity market behavior, currency market behavior following that Shanghai meeting. A possibility that an accord was struck there, or is that too speculative?
There's always the possibility, and that was, you know, just the way all this intervention came out. It is a possibility. Now, if they didn't come to some kind of agreement, if you look and see what happened here, there was the three meetings right in a row, right? The ECB, the BOJ, and the Fed meeting all came very close to each other. I'm sure they talked about it. That would be the courtesy, you know, the honor among thieves, so to speak, that we were all together. They could have given each other the heads up. They normally do, so there's no big surprises. There wasn't that big a surprise, really, in the Japan or the ECB. The big surprise was the Fed. Not only not hiking rates, but giving this, I think some people, I don't want to say Goldman Sachs for sure, but some of the brokers are saying this is one of the most dovish communiques in the new millennium here. And that's where people today are going, what is what, you know, you've had the last 2 or 3 days, you've had a series of hawkish pronouncements coming out of the Fed officials, and you're going, wait a minute, you give this incredibly dovish communique a week ago, and now you're out here talking hawkish. You guys, you lost credibility. If you go back to Bernanke, when you get a normalized policy, well, when unemployment hits 6.5, okay, hit 6.5. Well, okay, now it's 6. Okay, hit 6. Okay, now it's 5.5. Okay, well, now it's 5. Well, now you're at 4.9. But forget about it. Now we're looking at inflation. And we look at core. Well, core's 2.3 and it's going higher. Well, forget about that. And then you say, well, when are you going to hike rates? Well, we're data-driven. Oh, BS. I almost said the bad word there. Of course it's BS, because they keep violating. And not only do they not listen and not adhere to the thresholds, they keep moving the goalpost. And so you have no credibility. Then you come out with this ridiculously dovish communique, and now you're out there talking hawkish, because the street is going, you idiots are not data-driven, you're ignoring the inflation, and you're going to have to tighten rates some point in the future, much harder and much faster, because you're behind the inflation curve. Now, the other interesting thing here, and this is why I can't believe it didn't hike in March, we see that the core inflation is moving up very strongly here. That's above their 2% threshold. But when the CPI was soft in February, that was the bottom of oil and gasoline prices and other commodities. you had a 45-50% rally in oil and, you know, whatever, 30-40% hike in gasoline prices that are going to show up in March. So come the Fed meeting, the end of April, I think it's around the 26th, 28th, you're going to have, right before that, the March CPI. And unless the BLS comes in here and puts a fraudulent number on, that CPI should be huge because you got already the core buildup in there and you add the oil and gasoline in there. It should be a shocking number in the CPI. Then they're going to look like real idiots that they didn't hike in March. And for the life of me, I don't know why they didn't hike, knowing anybody with half a brain knows that with this big oil bounce and gasoline price bounce, you're going to have a problem in here in the March CPI when it's released in April. So now they're going to look behind the curve. They're going to look like idiots. And I think that's why some of these Fed guys are talking hawkish now. But why didn't they vote it? There's only one dissenter, Esther George. Are the other ones that gutless and chicken that they couldn't voice that they were against it? So April could be a very tough time for stocks. And the market's going to sense here that with a bad inflation number, the Fed's going to be forced to hike. The other thing is that the corporate earnings are probably not going to be good. You know, they're talking S&P earnings looking down 8.3% is the forecast. We know they'll beat that because they talk it down and then they play their little games to beat it. But the key is going to be the guidance going forward here. You know, April could be a very tough time here for the stocks. And I think you're going to see that after you get some performance gaming for the first quarter next week. And I think you're going to get some kind of short-term top at least put in for the performance gaming for Q1 and then look out in April. Could be a tough one.
In your history as an analyst, have you seen this many variables in play all at once? I mean, we've got U.S. issues, we've got European issues, we've got Japanese issues, we've got Chinese issues, whether it's the PMIs overseas, you know, industrial production here in the United States. You've got microeconomic issues, you've got macro structural issues, and then massive amounts of intervention and manipulation all in play at one time. Have you ever been in an environment like this?
No. And to back up one step is, yes, I've seen this chaos, which was 79-80. Remember, again, the OPEC taking over to Jimmy Carter in Afghanistan. You were also getting rid of Iraq. I mean, it was just so many things going on there. But the key point is what you said at the end. Unprecedented intervention, zero rates, negative rates, QE, and when this thing topples again, what are you going to do? If you monetize stocks and bail out the insiders, you think the Trump revolution is bad now? The only reason Trump exists is because the GOP squashed the Tea Party. People keep forgetting that you go back a few years, there were three women, I think, from the Tea Party that had a chance to win Senate seats. One was against Harry Reid, who was vulnerable. The GOP not only didn't support them, they undermined them. And the one won. They could have knocked out Harry Reid. But just think about this. This is a guy that kicks them in the groin every chance he gets. But the GOP establishment would rather undermine the Tea Party candidate and let Harry Reid just totally emasculate them as opposed to allowing a Tea Party candidate to beat an establishment candidate in the primary. Especially with women. You had three women. Of course, in one they were saying, well, she acts like a witch. She believes she's a witch. I forget what state she was in. But people forget that. They totally undermined the Tea Party. And that's why Trump popped up, because they did not allow that revolt. And it's over. And, you know, people have said this for a decade, that the first party that comes out for the average guy wins, because this has been a flat tail government where you give the billionaires and the big corporations, you give the trade deals, you give all the tax breaks, and then you give the indigents that are dependent on government increase their rate, and you just crush the middle class and the merchant class. And the first party comes out and says, yeah, trade deals suck, immigration's, you know, the whole litany here. And that's all Trump is doing. Trump is running Pat Buchanan's platform for 20 years ago. And I cannot forget it. He said, you know, you can't do this. And he was against the neocons with all this adventurism. And it had to be 10, 15 years ago, he wrote a column. I'll never forget the end of it. It was a republic, not an empire. He said, you can't keep this going around the world like all the Bush and the establishment. You want to do all this nation building, all this intervention, all this BS. And you want to do all these trade deals and you want to kill the average American. Trump is just taking that and running with it now. You know, and Sanders is to some degree. And if Hillary would win with all the bad stuff she's done and is likely to, you know, come down the pike here, this is, wow. I just want to see what the Fed's going to look like 3-4 years from now. It's going to be totally different. I think you're going to get rid of all these mandates, get them out of fiscal policy. You are dead right. There's some important issues, important restructuring that is going to be done. And are we going to do it voluntarily or is the market going to force it?
We live in very interesting times, and I appreciate your adding to the conversation and the insight. love visiting with you. Would be very interested in putting our heads together sometime towards the end of the year, because I think there's going to be a lot of things happening between now, and it might be interesting to have a conversation after November when we can look and say, okay, well, this is who we're dealing with, and this is perhaps what the restructuring might look like.
You're right. And if you get the anti-establishment candidate in November, it's deflation. But it's also going to produce some chaos in there. And that's what nobody has a good grip on. Is how does that shake out?
Let's take a look at it then. I look forward to our conversation. Thanks for joining us today.
Anytime.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Bill King. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.